Everybody, I'm Vita Cohn-Bredos, and welcome again, my friends, to the Ask Bea Show. I'll tell you, when I listen to the Beatles music, it's very, very difficult to be feeling down and out, right? Well, as you all know, I am a psychotherapist. I'm also a sex therapist. I'm the author of the groundbreaking book on relationships, For Better, For Worse, Forever, Discover the Path to Lasting Love. I am also the advice columnist for Dance Papers in the Hamptons and in Palm Beach. And as many of you know, I am a national speaker. I've been an expert guest in national radio and television for over 25 years. It's really amazing. I remember the very, very, very first time that I hosted an SBD call-in counseling radio show. It happened to be in Providence, Rhode Island. I remember how nervous I was. And I actually, believe it or not, I came into the studio to host the first Ask Beauty show. And I had a bulletin board with every single word that I was planning to speak all written down. Well, fortunately, with a lot of hard work and practice, I no longer need to do that. But I think that for all of us, nothing really comes all that easy. It takes a lot of determination and hard work, whether or not we're working on ourselves, on our relationships. And one of the real joys of my life, and I have been practicing as a psychotherapist. This is over and above my media work for over 35 years. And I have a private practice here in very, very cold but sunny New York City, and also in East Hampton. So you all have an opportunity in the next hour, actually every Monday from 3 to 4, to call me with any questions or comments that you may have. The call-in number is 888-874-4888. So what is the Ask Beauty Show really all about? In one word, it is really about empowerment. We talk about all of the things that we can do. And of course, do is the key action word. Not just think about, not just dream about, not just hope. Things that we can actually do to improve the quality of our lives and the quality of our relationships. So naturally, we talk about mental health issues, sexuality, and relationships, and how and what we can all do every single day to at least try to maximize our physical and emotional well-being, despite the stressors of life that we all have to deal with. So I have a mantra, and I really try in my own professional life and personal life to live by it. And the mantra is to be willing to acknowledge the ups and downs and the issues and the pain and the disappointments, and try as best as we can to address and resolve the things that continue to get in the way of our being able to really live a joyful life. And as you all know, this is not an easy feat. But there's one thing then I really, really do hope that I have convinced you and my readers and people who hear me on other television shows and radio shows, is that we do not need to navigate life's journey on our own. And that reaching out to family and friends, if you're really lucky enough to have positive, sensitive, empathic family and friends, they can really help to make our life journey easier. And if we don't have the family and friends, and of course at times, even if you have the best family and the best friends, you need to really give yourself permission to reach out and get some good professional mental health when you find that you're just going around and around in circles, that the issues are the same issues that you had a year ago or 5 years ago or 10 years ago, or you're making the same self-destructive, self-sabotaging, destructive decisions and choices that you've made for most of your life. And I think a lot of people think that, you know, if you go into therapy, this is going to be something that you're going to be doing for years and years. And although I have to acknowledge that there have been a few people and not that many patients in my entire career who have actually needed and have remained in therapy with me for many, many, many years. I mean, usually I find that if people are really willing to work hard, and if they have the self-discipline, and of course, if they have a really good, great therapist who knows what he or she is doing, you're really able to get through a lot of the major issues within a relatively short period of time. But of course, that really does vary from person to person and from situation to situation. So every week, and of course, every year, I ask all of you and all of really us, including myself, to take an honest look at how well or unfortunately, how badly we may be doing in our life. Because when you think about it, every year, most of us, we do schedule appointments with our physician and dentist to make sure that our bodies and our teeth are strong and healthy. So doesn't our mental health merit the same kind of attention? Now, although an annual psychological, it may not be feasible or certainly not needed for everyone, we can still do much to ensure that our emotional, our psychological, our psychiatric, and mental well-being is really on course. So this is a list, and I do, for those of you who listen to the Ask BD show every single week, you probably wonder, why did she go through the same self-assessment every single week? But the things that I'm asking you to look at, I mean, these are the things that literally make or break the joy, or on the other hand, the sorrow that we experience in our life. So here we go. This is not just for the year, but this is for the week. Generally speaking, if you're looking at your mental health, how are you doing? Are you generally happy with your life, your relationships, and the general direction that you're going in? Or have you found that it is a real, real struggle sometimes to get up in the mornings, that the depression, that the anxiety really does take over a good part of your life? For some people, they have lived with depression and anxiety for most of their lives, and this is not to blame anybody, but there are a lot of old issues. There are a lot of what I call skeletons in the closet and unfinished business that really do need to be processed. They need to be emotionally processed as best as we possibly can, because they do, in fact, get in the way of our being able to live happily and joyfully in the moment. And a lot of people might say, look, that's history. And there are a lot of therapists who practice behavioral therapy and CBT and DBT, and they feel that it is not really beneficial to go back. Well, I have to tell you that in my personal life, I am probably one of the most impatient people that you will ever, ever want to meet. You'll be able to ask my husband, Jim, who's going to be a guest on the show today and who will be coming into my studio in a few minutes. But seriously, if I had found a way over all of these years to fast forward the process of at least trying to emotionally work through what did and did not happen in our lives, whether we're talking about sexual abuse, whether we're talking about neglect or substance abuse of various different kinds, I would have found a way a long, long, long time ago, so that for people who do work with me, we actually do, we begin at the beginning. And when people go through this process, they tell me, and I know that it's absolutely true, that for the first time in their lives, again, nothing is perfect, but they are able to live mostly in the moment without having one foot in the past and one foot in the present. So again, if you are struggling, I do hope that I have convinced you that it is a good thing, that it is a strength, not a weakness, to reach out and get some really good emotional, mental help. And what about your relationships? Again, we have to be really, really honest if we're looking at our families, if we're looking at our children and our partners and our coworkers. What are these relationships really, really like? Do they bring us relative happiness and joy and peace? Or are you finding, like many of my patients, when they begin therapy, that they continue to play out toxic scenarios, very, very similar to the toxicity that they may very well have experienced as children? And again, it's important to really be honest with ourselves. And again, for those of you who have listened to me for all of these years, my feelings about toxicity is that a little bit of toxicity, a little bit of poison is still poison. And my goal in my life, and I feel that I've been really pretty successful being mindful of not wanting to have any toxicity in my life, is to have a zero toxicity plan, so that when I start to experience craziness in my personal life and some of my personal relationships, I mean, naturally you try to work things out. But if you try and you try and you don't have two people who are committed to a process of trying to improve the quality of the relationship, we are all much, much, much better off to extricate these relationships. And what about your professional and your financial stability? I mean, after all, we spend a lot of time at work. And of course, these days, people are so often working from home, which has really changed the entire dynamic of our work life. In fact, I was talking to a couple of young men who I treat, who happen to live in Chicago. And I was asking them, are you going to have a Christmas party from these are big financial institutions that they work for? And they would say, well, no, we never go into the office. We work exclusively from home. Our colleagues live in parts all around the United States. In fact, we've never even met any of our colleagues in person. So, of course, we're not going to be having a face-to-face Christmas celebration or Hanukkah celebration. And of course, I was then really curious to know whether they were planning to do anything on Zoom, which is a way, of course, so many people, including me, the way I've seen patients these days. And their answer was no. So again, I think we have to be very honest and asking ourselves, are we mostly contented? Are we mostly happy with the kind of work we're doing and how we are also doing financially? And if we are not, then of course, the real question is always then, what are we going to do about it? What about substance abuse? Again, asking yourself, being honest with yourself, are you concerned with any alcohol or prescription or even over-the-counter medication that you may be using? And have you suffered any negative consequences or repercussions in your relationship, whether it's at home or at work, as a result of your possible substance abuse? And I think you might want to ask close friend or partner or family member to just corroborate. And again, I think it is so important that we don't fool ourselves, about our relationships, and that we try to live our lives in a very authentic kind of way. And even though I'm a mental health professional, how can we not talk about our physical health and our physical well-being? And during the pandemic, it was very, very difficult for a lot of people to stay in shape. Although I have to tell you, I used to go to the gym all the time. But what I did instead was that I purchased weights and Every day, every single day, I lift weights and I try to walk as best as I possibly can in order to maintain good optimal health. So how is your health, and are you happy with your physical being, and are you taking care to eat well and to get, at least yearly blood work? And follow your doctor's advice, and again to exercise and to really take care of yourself, because this is the whole thing, is that we need to, and not just once a year and not just once a week when you're listening to the Ask Petey show, but to ask yourself again and to answer honestly, am I living my life in ways that are really in my best interest? And it's interesting too that a patient of mine just yesterday, she was saying, but that sounds selfish to be living your life in ways that are in your best interest. Trust me, it is not selfish to take care of yourself, to love yourself, to nurture yourself. And what about your sleeping patterns? Are you getting enough sleep? What about sex? Are you mostly satisfied with the quantity and quality of sex in your life, whether you do or do not have a partner? And in terms of sexual orientation and gender, and it is so great that in the media we're talking more and more and more about this, because all of these issues were closeted for so many years. So are you living an authentic life in terms of your gender and sexual orientation? And I know that I'm throwing a lot of things at you, but these are really important things in terms of self-care and goals. Do you have clarity about your goals? Do you actually have goals? Do you believe that they're realistic? Do you believe that they are achievable? So again, the real question boils down to this. If you find you are off track, and we have all been off track at different times in our lives, are you actually ready to make some positive changes in your life and relationships and create the life that you want and create the life that you deserve? Or, on the other hand, are you going to continue to avoid and deny and blame and be defensive and continue to live your life in a downward spiral? And that is really your choice, because if we refuse to step up to the plate and confront our demons, the old and the new ones, it becomes increasingly more difficult to fully enjoy your life. So what I'm hoping, we can't change history, we can't change anything that's happened even a second ago. So I'm hoping that for today and for 2023, that you are going to embrace some of this and ask yourself whether or not you are loving yourself, whether or not you are behaving in constructive, positive ways that are actually in your best interest. And I have every confidence in you that if you make that choice, you can really transform your life and live a well-deserved life that we actually all deserve. Well, I am very excited to have a guest today. And well, I'm actually always very excited to have guests. But my guest today is my husband, Jim Fredos, who is a professor, who is a sociologist and a criminologist. And for those of you who have not seen his great television show, this has been going on now for 8 years, The Radical Imagination on MNMTV. It airs Sunday nights, and it airs actually many, many other times during the week. It's a great show. So, hi, I'm so glad that
Hey,
you're here. We're
it's a blessing and a joy to be here. And yes, the show is on all the time, 3 in the morning. You could just put it on, but no, 8 o'clock is the first time that it'll get there. But thank you so very much for asking me to be here today. And what are we talking about? Some monumental issue, right?
a lot to talk about because, you know, our audience should know that we talk about all these things all the time anyways, all these different issues, the sociological issues and the mental health issues. So I figured, you know what, instead of just talking about it today, you know, in our living room, that we should actually talk about this on the Ask Beanie Show. Well, this is something that was in the New York Times, and I know that I didn't even tell you that we were going to be discussing this, but this was an article. It appeared last week, attempting to get more men to try therapy. So let me just read their initial paragraph, and then you can respond. Mental health experts change their approach toward a group that often seems reluctant. This is a piece by a Dana Smith. So this is what Dana Smith happens to say. Mental health experts have long known that while women have nearly twice the rate of depression diagnosis, men are much more likely to die by suicide, drug overdose, and alcohol-related deaths, sometimes referred to as deaths of despair. Nearly 80% of suicide, and this may be something that I'm not sure you knew, I was a little surprised, I didn't think it was this high, 80% of suicides are among men, with men over the age of 75, Jim, and those who work in traditionally blue-collar jobs as mines, construction, and agriculture, they have the highest rates. And despite men's higher risk of death related to mental illness, women are more likely, of course, to seek help. And in 2020, 15% of men reported receiving either psychotropic medication or therapy. And in the past year, compared with 26% of women, the disparity in care has left experts scrambling for ways to reach more men who may be reluctant to talk about their mental health issues. So what do you think? This has not been my experience, by the way, as a therapist. I've had practices in many different cities where 30, 40, 50% of the time my patients have been men. So what are your thoughts about men being reluctant and what we need to actually do to encourage men that it is okay, that they are still men, that they are still masculine if they reach out and ask for professional mental health?
Yeah. Well, those are the statistics you brought out there, especially among blue-collar men. There, of course, are certain professions, including psychotherapy, psychotherapists and physicians, and actually academics, too, have high rates of suicide. So, but the it seems like, again, the blue-collar workers, this is quite a rise, probably due to the severe economic conditions we've been facing the last several years. Them hard, perhaps harder than other groups. But I would say this. First of all, as you know, I am a man who was not reluctant to go get therapy, and as a grad student, I found that I was mildly depressed for a relationship that had broken up, and I was in an intense program that was a lot of pressure, and so on. So I did very willingly go to the head of the student mental health services and started therapy there. So I am a male who found the experience to be extremely helpful and worthwhile. But it's an interesting question. How do we get people to be more willing to open up and take that chance bettering their situation in life? It's a difficult decision to make.
And yet what's so interesting, Jim, is that really that has not been my experience. I think over the years, I've treated some of the most, in quotes, masculine, some of the most successful men in the United States who were not reluctant to
What do you make of that?
In.
Because it's not what you've just said here, right? In the statistics. So what do you make of that in terms of your own patient group that you've...
Well, when I think about it, maybe, and I haven't really thought about it in this way, maybe it was because of my, in quotes, branding. I mean, I've been in national radio and television for forever, and maybe it made it okay for these men to seek help with someone who had a fair bit of notoriety. I'm not sure.
Yeah.
But...
They- I saw you some sort of kindred soul they could trust, it seems like.
And did. I mean, yeah. Men of all ages. I mean, if you, my dear husband, and audience had heard a couple of sessions that I had over the weekend with two young men in their 20s, 25 and 27 separately, where we were talking about erection, where we were talking about performance anxiety, where we were talking about they were not really sure, you know, even though they were not dating, how they would approach a woman sexually, whether or not they were going to be able to satisfy a woman sexually. And here we were. It was really interesting that here on Zoom, yeah. In their pajamas, sitting around their apartment on a sofa, both of these men, and of course, separate apartments, they don't know each other, really being grateful, because I asked them at the end of the session how they felt. I mean, I've been working with them for probably 3 to 6 months. So they, you know, they know me. We still haven't met in person. Everything is on Zoom. They both said, independently, what a relief it was to be able to talk about relationships, to be able to talk about dating, and to be able to talk about their own concerns and anxieties about sex.
Particularly with a female therapist.
Right.
Like, well, that tells you a lot about your own capabilities and ability to connect. I know in my own particular case, with the dynamics that I was involved in, I found that for me, it was much more, just more beneficial for me to get involved with an older male therapist, uh-huh. which I did, and so on. But, and that's another, I guess, issue. I think, first of all, you got to get people willing and able to open up to the possibility of therapy.
Right.
And again, as you mentioned before, you know, blue-collar workers are not, it's not part of that culture necessarily. To think of that, whereas in other cultural groups, more middle, upper middle class, but I think that's beginning to change, and I think that's the change for the better.
Do you really believe that, though? I mean, that the even though these statistics that are cited, you know, make reference to, you know, blue collar men, I think that it's a really big deal for all of us, whether or not we are male or female or gay or straight or trans or bi, to actually make a decision to reach out. It takes a lot of courage. It does.
Well, yeah, I guess, you know, again, just talking personally, it wasn't a huge big decision. I mean, it came fairly naturally. As you know, I like to talk a lot. I was open. As a sociologist, I was used to a certain education where there was a lot of analyzing and talking back and forth. Again, I went to graduate school at a time when there was a great deal of dialogue and activism and so on. So this was sort of a natural for me. But no, I hear what you're saying. People really have to come to the point of their lives where, hey, you really seriously, otherwise it's no good. If you're just going to play around with this, you've got to seriously commit yourself to I would add, a very, very unique relationship that, as far as I'm concerned, does not exist anywhere. This is a very, very, very unique relationship that one has with a therapist. It's not just your best friend here and so on, as you all know.
No, exactly. And I just want to let my audience know is that sometimes it's going to take a couple of attempts to find the right therapist. All therapists are not the same. You are not going to have the same feeling. You're not going to have the same connection. You're not going to have the same kind of comfort level, you know, with everybody. So that if your first or second attempt, if it's not working, I mean, ideally, you know, try and get a referral from somebody who you know and somebody who you trust, who knows a little bit about you and who knows about the referring, you know, mental health professional. But something so,
if I get made, I think that's a very, very important point. And again, I went to the student health services and I lucked out with my particular therapist, who's head of that service, by the way. But and then he took me on as a private patient. But again, what I think is happening And you've talked about this on your shows a lot too, over the pandemic and the economic distress and so on and so on. I think that the issues of emotional distress and, if you will, mental illness, emotional illness, if you will, has increased. And we need to have mental health services keep up with enormous numbers of people who are now needing and wanting these services.
And of course, we have issues in this country. As a Canadian, I am talking and I am very, very disappointed in what I see in the American mental health world. If you don't have insurance, I mean, it becomes
and it's an expensive venture.
It's an expensive
without the subsidies or help from the government, which is, of course, pulling teeth at times.
Exactly. Just apropos this article, and I wanted to get onto a couple of other things today in talking with you. Apparently, a Dr. Spencer Thomas teamed up with the Colorado Department of Public Health and Environment and the branding agency. Again, here we are talking about branding and PR and image to develop a public health campaign called Man Therapy. Listen, everybody, Man Therapy, that they hoped would engage men who identify with more traditional concepts of masculinity. Now, this is online. But it's a first step. You know, people can start to go online and they can read a little bit about man therapy, and then they can read about therapy, and then hopefully we'll be able to give themselves permission to reach out and ask for help.
Yeah, let me try and try to be as objective as I can. I guess I'm sort of old fashioned on this. And the whole idea of branding all of this, of course, that's what America's does with just about anything. And I think, again, the sort of psychotherapy I had was a venture that I entered into that wasn't involving several years. So this is not just something. I'm not saying that this organization you're mentioning is bad. I think it's important to get the message out and to get a whole bunch of people interested in at least talking about it. And at that level, I think it's very important. And I think it's a good thing.
All right. Well, moving along here to another issue and another subject. And this was actually a column that I wrote in Dan's Papers. As you know, that I am the advice columnist for Dan's Papers in the Hamptons and also in Palm Beach. So the article was, "Are you enabling people to hurt you?" Now, quote, "My children disrespect me. He cheats on me. She drinks too much. She refuses to have sex. He abuses me." And these are typical complaints that I hear from my patients on a regular basis when they begin therapy with me. "It's certainly very disappointing, frustrating, and at times frightening to be in a dysfunctional, unhappy relationship. However, of course, whether we're talking about mental health or physical health. However, I believe an all-important underlying question that we all need to be willing to answer honestly is, why am I allowing my partner, my children, my colleagues, my friends, my business associates to disrespect and hurt me? And more importantly, again, what, if anything, am I prepared to do about it?" So what are your thoughts?
Well, the first thought that comes to mind is to find out if the person who is being abused even knows that they're being abused. In other words, this might be a normal for them because they've been abused their whole life and they enter into a relationship. So isn't that part of the therapeutic effort to get them to see that this is not ordinary and this is not normal and that they need to break out of this?
Well, you're absolutely right. And knowing that you're in an abusive relationship intellectually is not sufficient enough in terms of your emotional awareness or self-awareness that this is, in fact, and you're absolutely right, Jim. So oftentimes, the abuse that has begun when someone was a young child continues throughout their entire life unless it gets so bad, unless there are so many crises where the person is that willing to say, "Hey, I think that there's something off here. There's something wrong, and I need to do something about it." I mean, I see many people who begin therapy with me who are basically playing out their abusive childhoods in their adult relationships because the abuse is familiar. So you are exactly right.
No, but again, unless there's some sort of intervention, these people's lives, whether it could be a teacher, a religious leader, again, or a school therapist, or whatever, there has to be somebody, seems to me, to come in there and begin to get that person to think that this is not a normal way of. And that's, again, it could be very much depending on the luck of the draw, whether you have that experience. And so many people go through lives where it is self-destructive and they are very abused and they begin to take it out on others, themselves, they get in trouble with the law. Perhaps 30-40% of the people in prison have extremely emotional distress issues that should be dealt with very, very, very deeply with the two mental health officials, and they're not getting it.
Well, and that these people who have been in prison, you know, for years and years and years and committed terrible, terrible crimes, I mean, what we have found, what you have found, what Dr. Hilligan has found, is that the majority were severely abused as children and basically, again, played out the dynamic, the abusive dynamics that they sustained as children and acted out in their adult lives to hurt others, when in fact, beneath the surface, they were hurting a great, 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 you know, deal.
Exactly.
But again, I think we have to ask ourselves the questions, right? Even though the abuse may be familiar, or even though the abuse, you know, is familiar to all of us, if you're seeing that you're going down a path that's self-destructive, self-sabotaging, destructive, it needs to be willing to ask yourself the question, which is why I ask people these questions every single week here on the Ask BD Show, to at least ask the question, you know, what's going on? Why am I with so-and-so-and-so-and-so who continues to abuse me? Yeah. Why have I spent most of my adult life in relationships with people who hurt me? So asking that question, you know, is the first step.
Well, it's very, very difficult because oftentimes, as you were pointing out, you're involved with people that you think you're in love with, or family members who perhaps have shown you some love anyway, some nurturing. But it gets more complicated. There's a lot of mixed feelings, I would imagine. It's not just total abuse,
right.
Total toxicity. It could be just now and then. But it, as you point out, you know, when you have a little of it, it still is very damaging, or can be. So again, this question you're raising is so, so important. And I would say especially, well, it's, of course, all times of the year, but here we are entering the holiday season with all kinds of talk about peace and harmony and forgiveness, redemption, and salvation, and so on. So this is a very important issue you're raising here, individually and collectively.
And also, you know, people might be listening right now and say, well, what does it actually mean to be an enabler? Well, let me give you a definition, my definition. An enabler is someone who, for a variety of reasons, first of all, feels powerless and has learned and is willing to accept destructive and self-destructive behavior. And some of these explanations include fear of abandonment. I mean, I hear this all the time. I would rather be with him, or I'd rather be with her than be alone. I can't be alone. And as you rightly pointed out, Jim, in the worst of relationships, in the most violent, toxic relationships, there are always good times. Yeah. And it's those good times that keep people in these relationships, coupled with fear of abandonment, fear of financial ruin, of course, poor self-esteem, a family history where these types of behaviors were normalized or accepted.
And lack of availability of other alternatives. They see no way out of this, in a sense, correct?
No, exactly. But again, if you find you're in this kind of cycle, you know, there's help. I mean, there's certainly help out there around the country. There's help here every single week, you know, on my show here on the Progressive Radio Network. And this is where I really do try and encourage people to call in. I mean, this initially was supposed to, ideally, to be a call-in counseling radio show. as I had hosted in the past. If you have comments, if you have questions, you know, all you really need to do is go to my, you know, beatycone.com website, and you have all of the contact information, and I will respond to your emails and your questions. But moving along to another subject, a big subject, making amends with people who we have hurt. And I believe, if it's at all possible, that it is a win-win way to live. And I want to just give a little bit of an intro here, and then I'm very interested in hearing what you have to say, Jim. Let's face it. There is not a person alive, not you, not me, who has not at some point in their life intentionally or even unintentionally hurt another human being emotionally, physically, verbally, financially, or sexually. Now, when I was a child growing up in Winnipeg, Canada, I mean, of course, nothing was perfect, but my parents and teachers were models of kindness, generosity of spirit, and good manners. And please and thank you, and can I help you, and I'm so sorry, were phrases that I routinely heard, you know, people say to one another. And it was also, I think, the kinder, gentler Canadian society and culture that I grew up in that reinforced these kinds of values and behavior. But the real question that I want to ask everyone is that, are there people in your life who you have hurt or harmed and would like to try and make amends? And perhaps it's your children or family or significant other or coworker or friend you have hurt. And, you know, question, what stopped you in the past from apologizing? Was it false pride or anger or fear of not being forgiven that stopped you from doing what I believe is the right thing? Again, even though we can't change what we did or didn't do, I have found that the emotional, psychological, and even physical relief that people feel when they take responsibility for their own hurtful and harmful behavior cannot be underestimated. And of course, you talk a lot, Jim, in the criminal justice world about restorative justice.
Well, yes, restorative justice.
Explain that.
Well, I will just say, but again, you think you hit the nail on the head. You have to somehow get people to the point where they even are capable or willing to forgive or make amends. And there could be so conflicted, whether it's a society, culture, or individuals, they're so conflicted in their emotions that they have anger and disappointment and depression that all this has to be sorted out. And at that point, they can begin to ask for forgiveness and make tikkun olam, to begin to heal those who they have hurt and to be healed themselves. So that's the hard question to answer. You know, restorative justice tries to put people together, victims and those who have victimized them. You have to have, you know, two to tango here. You have to be working with people who are truly sorry for what they've done. They have to come to that point, and that takes work. And then you have to have on the other side people who are willing to open up their heart again and forgive. And this is a very, very difficult process, both politically with various groups around the world. I mean, think of the hurts and the constant, you know, the pattern of violence that's gone on in the country with blacks and whites or Palestinians and Israelis. I mean, you can go around Ukrainians and Russians, the Irish and the Brits. I mean, it goes on and on and on. So we need therapeutic help, and we need to get people a stage of their maturity where they can begin to start loving again. And again, as you point out in your shows over and over again, you first have to love yourself. And then you could turn to others and to radical love, express that empathy and maturity that hopefully many of us in the world will be able to do.
Well, I think, yes, you're absolutely, you know, absolutely right. And, you know, one of the things that I was thinking about you know, I'm doing some consultation at East Hampton High School in East Hampton, New York. And I think it's sort of an approach, you know, a restorative justice approach where people who have hurt one another and people who at least are willing to hear the apology, that this kind of thing be taught in schools as well, and in the synagogues and in the churches and in the mosques, so that we would all become a lot more conscious of how we treated one another. But I have a question for you, Jim. I also have a question for my audience, and I had the same question for myself. Have we hurt people, even recently or in the distant future, that we feel that we would like to contact either by email or phone or letter and try to make amends? Now, I had someone that I wanted to make amends with, and I'll tell the audience a little brief story. I had two amazingly wonderful friends when I lived in Sarasota, a married couple. And we had a disagreement. In fact, they owned a magazine, and I used to write an AskBD column for them. And I had decided at one point that I wanted to write an AskBD column for an even more major magazine. And they made me choose. And they told me that in choosing the major magazine, that they were not going to carry my column. And these were very, very, very close friends. And as a result, you know, I literally terminated my relationship with them. Now, this goes back 10 years ago. And I was thinking about this recently when I was writing the column. And I owed them an apology. We needed to talk about all of this. And when I was in Sarasota recently, as you know, we met and we were able to talk about this. And they were able to explain their position, and I was able to explain my hurt and disappointment. And I felt so great in not just walking away from a relationship that had been very, very important to me, and that we were able to discuss and make amends and be able to move forward. So with you, are there relationships that you can think about right now where you feel that you would like to make amends?
Well, sure, as I think most people listening to the show, but I did want to mention the example you're giving there. I mean, it sounded like they owed you an apology too.
Yes.
Again, it was sort of, I thought, not a very nice thing that they put, the demand that they put on you. But again, it's that, you know, cutting people off and shutting people out and not being, ghosting them. And and again, you raise an important point that you felt, even though they may not have been reciprocal to your wish to make amends, it still felt good for you. You were at the point where this needed to happen, and if they didn't respond, that's part of the game here, part of the chance you take. They thankfully did respond, and you're back having a wonderful relationship.
But I think a more honest relationship, because if we tiptoe around people and tiptoe around issues and things that bother us, but we don't express our feelings, sooner or later, this all catches up. So the real question, of course, is, so what are you supposed to say and what are you supposed to do when making amends? Well, the first thing is to start with a very thoughtful, serious apology, right?
Absolutely. And an apology is true. You know, again, how you can measure this, but it's got to be really, truly, it's got to be a true apology from the bottom of the heart. No playing around here, no phony baloney stuff. You've got to really go deep within yourself and come out with the truth, with your true feelings, and be willing to get hurt, perhaps even in that. And then that truthfulness and the integrity of that apology will shine through.
Right. And just being able, those words, I mean, how many of us, you know, are routinely able to say, I'm sorry. I'm sorry for being late to a meeting. I'm sorry for hurting your feelings. I'm sorry for not following through. I'm sorry for ghosting you. I mean, I wonder these days, how many of us do this and are willing to put our egos aside and stop making excuses for our bad behavior and actually say, I'm sorry, I would love to hear, I would love to know from people who are listening to the show right now, you know, what they're thinking, you know, what they're feeling about all of this in their own lives. So again, start with a thoughtful apology, okay? Number two, we have to take responsibility for our actions. Don't deny responsibility for the harm you've caused, even if you think it was someone else's fault.
Oh, I think it's self-explanatory. You just have to be honest with yourself. And when that honesty, I mean, it does go back to basic honesty, whether you're in Canada or, right. I don't know, the South Sea Islands or New York City. A general good rule to live by, to be as honest with yourself as possible. And that's what you're talking about.
And when we mess up, not be reluctant to, you know, acknowledge it, because we all mess up.
I think that's so, so very important. And again, as the sociologist has come out here, why is it so difficult for some cultures to do that and others to not? I think in this culture, we've had such difficulties just coming to grips. In fact, we're still in such great denial of the hurts and the violence that we perpetuated on, whether it's Native Americans or immigrant groups and certain blacks and so on. It's like pulling so many teeth to even get some sort of bare minimum apology. And that tells you something about the dominant culture. So anyway, yeah, it's difficult. But needs to be done.
It definitely needs to be done. Number three, so we're talking, start with a thoughtful apology. Number one. Number two, take responsibility for your actions. Number three, admit what you did wrong. Because one of the most important parts of making amends is being really specific about what you did or didn't do that caused the other person pain or harm. And don't try to justify what happened. Simply admit that your actions were wrong without explaining why they occurred in the first place. No one is interested in hearing, I was too tired or too drunk to know what I was doing. Step up and be willing to own your own hurtful behavior.
Yeah, you come clean, and then in your therapy, you go into why you acted the way you did. But I think you're right. You just, when you're dealing with friends or people you've hurt, just, they don't want to hear all of that. That's for the therapist and for you to work out, but you just come clean.
And of course, you know, Jim, there's no guarantee. I mean, you can be the most righteous person and want to really try to make amends, and sometimes the pain and the hurt simply too great, and people are saying no, or not now, or maybe not ever.
Unfortunately, it's so true. And the truth tellers who come along, well, rarely, thinking people like Martin Luther King and so on, Gandhi, they often meet with, you know, demise, because of the people in society just can't bear hearing that truth. And hopefully, as we mature as a country and as individuals within our own personal relationships, we get to the point where we can really deal with that at a much more mature level.
No, exactly. And number four, genuinely feel remorse. It is important to genuinely feel remorse for the person you hurt, what you did, and the pain that you caused. And we need to find ways to convey these feelings, not in an offhanded way, but in a very genuine way, if your apology has a chance at all to be accepted, you know. And you don't want to just be very fluffy about the whole thing. Yeah, you know, I just had a bad day, and, you know, I hope you get it, and, you know, we're going to be really good again. That is not going to do it for most people.
Yeah.
Number five, ask for forgiveness. And when asking for forgiveness, again, you must be sincere. And this means that you must be willing to accept any consequences for your actions, no matter how severe they may be. You also need to be ready to commit to changing your behavior. It's not just enough to say, I'm sorry. Yeah. But if your certain kinds of behavior or words were really hurtful, if you do the same thing over and over again, I mean, nothing is going to change. So there needs to be a commitment to really make some changes. And as I always say, it's not what you say, it's what you do that really demonstrates your seriousness and commitment to change your actions and behavior that caused another person pain and harm. And number five, you need to ask also, what can I do to make this right?
Right. Whether it's that it's a sense of restorative justice and like reparations and truth and reconciliation committees and how do you make amends concretely and symbolically?
Right. Well, you know, somebody might say, you know, I may be willing, you know, to give you a chance, but I need A, B, C, and D. And as I say, the proof's in the pudding. It's not what you say, it's what you do. So you're going to be able to see over a period of time, you're going to be able, the person who was hurt and the person who did the hurting, are both going to be able to see whether or not the dynamic is in fact going to change. And if it does, then maybe a reconciliation is going to be possible. Right. If it doesn't, then you've tried, but it hasn't worked. And I am amazed, Jim. Look at the time here.
I am looking at it.
It is 3:56.
But this is a tremendous message you're getting out there. And if we could just follow what you're talking about individually, collectively, this would be so much better world. And you know, I think it's a very wonderful, great service you're giving here for the holiday season.
I think it's an important topic. When I wrote the article, I thought this was something that I really wanted to discuss with you and discuss with the listeners. So everybody, another SBD show has come and almost is gone. And I want to thank you so much for listening as you always do. And I want to also leave you with my two weekly messages. And for those of you who've been listening all these years, you know what the messages are. The first, of course, is to do everything possible that you can do to live your life in ways that are in your best interest, which that means really learning to love yourself. And secondly, we all need to do, as we're discussing today, Jim, a much, 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 much better job in learning to love each other. So again, I want to thank you so much.
Thank you. And to all in the audience, and make amends to those family members that you've been reluctant to make amends toward. This is the season to do it. It's always the season. But again, thank you so very much, Bea, for being on.
Well, I'm glad we'll have to do it again really soon.
We have
lots to talk about it again. Thank you all so much for listening. And I wish you all a very, very happy, and healthy holiday. And of course, tonight is the first night of Hanukkah. So remember, we're going to be lighting candles and embracing one another. So have a good rest of the day and good week. And I will talk with you soon. Bye-bye, everybody.